This meeting is being live streamed. We're legally obligated to tell you that in the state of California. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlisle, joined by Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is Jason Buck La Cucaracha. How are you, Jason?
I like that. I'm going to start using that. I'm going to try to get my girlfriend to call me that. Just like by the way, your tweet was epic with the Uncle Buck reference. Like, I've been trying to get my nieces and nephews to call me that, and it's just not working out.
Toby, I didn't know that you had to read that disclaimer at the very beginning. I always thought it was just one of those, like,
I just do it anyway.
Okay. I thought it was like one of those Ron Burgundy things where he just reads whatever's on the screen in front of him.
It is a little bit like that. It is a little bit like, I just do it for fun. I think it's funny.
This meeting's being live streamed?
Yeah. Speaking of which, Toby, do you do another disclaimer where I like, nothing I say is investment advice? Seek out investment professionals. None of these guys, you know, none of us. We're just some guys on the internet, you know?
I think people can tell from watching that that's true.
You would think, but like, yeah, as you know, we have to say all that. By the way, there was a, what is it? When Prince Charles was ascending to the throne, you know, there's all these protests outside of Buckingham Palace. And there's all these signs like, not my king, not my, like all these kind of things. My favorite sign of all time is just said, he's just some guy.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that applies to all of us. Like, we're just some guy on the internet. Don't take advice from us on anything.
I don't think there's any risk of that. So I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, that's true.
Jason, I called you La Cucaracha because you run the Cockroach Fund. What is the Cockroach Fund?
Man, right to the point. So
yeah, well, just let the people know.
No, so. No foreplay here, Jason. We're just
Exactly. No lube. So basically, my partner Taylor Pearson and I built exactly what we wanted for ourselves and our families, and then we just kind of opened it up to outside investors. But the idea with, you know, a cockroach is it can survive anything. So we feel like, you know, people think they have broad portfolio diversification when they look at that pie chart, but usually it's just purely offensive assets. And then we see in like a March 2020, correlations go to one, everything goes down together. That shows them that they're really just long GDP and offensive assets. So what we wanted to really bring to market was specializing in the defensive side. And on the defensive side, we used long volatility, tail risk, commodity trend advisors, et cetera. And the idea is pairing offense and defense will win investing championships over the long run and help you compound portfolios to maximize your log wealth because you're reducing that volatility tax or that drawdowns that can make you do stupid things. So we like to pair offense plus defense. And then we kind of used Harry Brown's four quadrant model that goes back to the 1970s. They're on the axes of growth and inflation. You know, where they're in growth or recession, inflation or deflation. It's kind of a Venn diagram. They overlap. But the idea is there that that's kind of the global four macro quadrants that we want to cover and overlay those with offensive defense. And then hopefully our portfolio kind of muddles along in any macro environment. And like Toby said, that's what, you know, it's a cockroach. What survives everything? Roaches. Always cockroaches.
Yeah, it kind of predict.
Fits that great racing quote about you want to win the race as slowly as you can.
Just
don't crash, right?
Yeah, who is that? Alain Prost or something like that?
Niki Lauda.
Really?
Yeah.
He wants to win as slowly as possible.
Yeah, David Dredge, another vol manager, has the best one. Is like, it's not the fastest car that wins in F1, it's the one with the best brakes. Because in those turns and those coming out of those turns is when then you can accelerate, you know, and then it's your average speed going to Niki Lauda, it's your average speed over time. And the other one I've been using recently when I was just speaking in South Carolina was the Tour de France. And the idea there is like, you know, it's your average speed over time over those 21 grueling stages. And I point out that, you know, even Lance Armstrong over his 7 titles, only won 24% of those stages out of 147 total stages. And so nowadays, I think you have the average speed of 26.1 miles an hour to win the Tour de France. And actually, two people in history have actually never held the yellow jersey till the very last day. So it's that average time, average speed. So once again, it's what we're talking about is we're referencing compounded versus arithmetic returns, right? And it's, you know, the idea of, you know, your actual path or your sequencing risk through time, you know, compounds and, you know, the volatility tax can greatly destroy your portfolio. But I don't think a lot of people think about that too much.
Well, they don't. And it's one of the perhaps most important and overlooked mental models, I think, in finance, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to a book, like audio book earlier, and they were talking about alternative investments. And the so I think we lost Toby, so hopefully we'll jump back in here. Hopefully your co-host there.
Oh, gosh.
They, Like the they said alternative investments like private equity and real estate and venture capital. I'm like, what? Those are alternative investments? No, those are just leveraged up equity. You know, like these are not alternative investments. I think of alternatives as like, you know, things that are uncorrelated or negatively correlated. But yeah, when we look at the offensive assets, PE, VC, real estate, and all the different ilks of that, whether it's private credit, et cetera, those are just highly levered equity positions. And I think that's where people think they're getting that diversification. But like we're saying, they're just highly offensive or now just even multiple levered to offensive assets.
And how much do you think, Jason, is it like, how many implicit rates bets are being placed and maybe unknowingly?
Yeah, I think that's the hard part about any sort of offensive asset is I would say you're implicitly short volatility, but another way to say is that like you're long GDP or you're long liquidity. And somewhat within that rates bets, that liquidity constraint, right? And so that's what, yeah, people are, you know, and nowadays, you know, I think people got accustomed to the last 30, 40 years of stock bond correlations being negative. And then now we see in inflationary times is usually when they're positive. And then so then people are hoping for that, you know, rates bet to come back and we'll see if it happens or not. I mean, I don't have crystal ball, so I can't predict the future. But like you said, everybody's pleading for the times to come back that they got used to for the last 40 years.
Yeah. And so how did 2022, I imagine, must have been felt a little vindicating, I would guess.
Yes and no, it's hard. I
You
mean,
don't want to take victory laps ever and tempt
yeah.
the gods, but still, like, isn't that exactly what you were had in mind when you were building?
Yeah, so I think about we still are very offensive. We still use global stocks and global bonds, right? And then we just pair that with the defensive assets with the long volatility and the commodity trend. And so, you know, even having that exposure to stocks and bonds, you know, obviously they had that drawdown in 22. But then they're ballast primarily by the commodity trend side and a little bit by volatility. We can talk about the dispersion of returns there. So yeah, it felt vindicated, except at the same time, I believe in absolute returns. And so even though our portfolio was slightly negative, you know, during 22, it was, you know, relative value dramatically outperformed most people's 60-40 portfolios. But that's why you also don't take a victory lap is because I still believe in absolute returns. So it's like, it's kind of like, what have you done for me lately kind of thing, but also like, oh, you were down too, but like, you know, dramatically different, you know,
Hole to dig
exposure to
out
that
of,
down
yeah.
move. Yeah. And so, yeah. And then as you're saying, the hole to dig out of, you know, if you're down 20%, you got to go up 25%, right? If you're down, you know, 5%, you only got to go up a little bit more than five. So it's like, it's once again, that volatility tax greatly reduces the compounding. But then what happens is, right, after 22, people then forget in 23 when their stocks and bonds are back up, they forget about the compounding through time. They look at the arithmetic return and they look at what their neighbor's getting and they go, yeah, we're crushing that. Like, so it's also like that's the hard part when you're broadly diversified. You always have a part of your portfolio that you absolutely suck, that, you know, makes you want to throw up, that you want to just punch yourself in the head for. And then all the news media tell you you're an idiot for owning it. But that's proper diversification. If you like everything in your portfolio, you're obviously not diversified. And then the other part of it is that to do anything different from your neighbors, you know, you're going to look like a schmuck most of the time. Like you said, you're not going to take that victory lap when you don't have their drawdowns. You know, you can't gloat in their face, but they're definitely going to gloat in your face when stocks are ripping.
When they're ripping in, everyone's a genius.
Exactly.
Yeah, that is the tough part of this game. Do you think that how much of the strategy for the Cockroach Fund is really about guarding yourself from your own behavioral mistakes?
You nailed it. Like, so this one's, I think, one of the hardest things to talk about in finance, especially when you're talking to like financial advisors and everybody, like, we don't want to talk about this, but like, I talk about it freely. It's like babysitter tax, right? Like, people use financial advisors a lot of times so they don't do anything stupid. And I'm sure you guys have seen all the research is like the average, like, mutual fund owner reduce, like, they have anywhere from 1 to 6% drag compared to the actual mutual fund if they held it for the majority of the time they were in there because they're trying to time the markets. And so one, you have the timing aspect of just like good times. And then more importantly, behaviorally, you have that drawdown tax or that drawdown cost that people don't realize is like, you know, in 2008, when, you know, stock market's down over 50%, most people capitulated right at the bottom and they said, I'm never getting stocks again, never getting stocks again. And they missed all that run up to try to now they, like you said, they had to make 100% to get back to even. And they missed out on that. And then they maybe jump in back in 2012. And so it's behaviorally, it's really hard to handle a lot of these things. So that's why we think that adding those defensive sides to the portfolio, if you're in an inflationary environment, a protracted recession, or even a sharp liquidity risk, to have those things in your portfolio that provide the ballast to that portfolio, it keeps you from doing those stupid things. And so, like you're saying, it's that behavioral ability to kind of hold all that is extremely helpful. Now, granted, the hard behavioral side, like we referenced, is if your neighbors are ripping on stocks, keeping up with the Joneses is over a shorter periods is hard to do. But then one is that allows you to not lose your head and do stupid things. But then two, we rebalance the portfolio monthly because we offer monthly liquidity to our clients. Like we can argue over re if rebalancing bands are better or, you know, just temporary or temporal horizons with monthly rebalancing. But by us rebalancing monthly, that also keeps people from doing anything crazy as far as rebalancing those four kind of return drivers and asset classes. So for example, say in March of 2020, you know, stock market tanks off, you know, and pretty much everything else on that offensive side, you know, correlations go to one. Say if somebody had a tail risk on their books, you know, that tail risk position, it just convex cash position. Now you're just flush with cash. But more important than that, than balancing the portfolio and doing anything stupid, if you rebalance April 1st and now you're buying stocks at that lower NAV point,
Yeah.
that's what actually increases your compounding over time. And so it's a little bit of like truncating the left tail so you don't do anything stupid, but more importantly, buying those offensive assets when they're on the cheap and the compounding
Yeah.
average of that over time is going to dramatically increase your log wealth.
It's like when you force turnovers, you often get good field position.
Exactly. Have you ever seen, I want to see, somebody just told me about it at this event called like Punalytics. Have you ever seen this site?
No.
Because I was given the examples that like Chris Cole wrote a great paper on Dennis Rodman to show like how he's the lowest scoring basketball player to ever get in the Hall of Fame, but how much he dramatically improved the winning percentage of any team he played on because of his rebounding ability. And at his height, he was 6 standard deviations better than any other rebounder in the league. I mean, it's truly phenomenal. And so this guy was asking me for other examples, and I started thinking about what I wanted to maybe do a research on is like punters in the NFL. Like you're saying, is like,
Yeah.
if you can peg people within that, you know, 5 to 10 yards of the goal line, like how much that affects a game over time or the winning percentage of that team throughout the season. And so if you have like a Pat McAfee, like a Pro Bowl punter, you know, we're not thinking about that as often as we are thinking about like the big plays by the wide receivers or the running backs. We're not thinking about the validity of that. Although I would argue that in the Moneyball era, I bet the NFL is paying very close attention to that.
Yeah, they have to be, right? I mean, there's probably on a per yard basis, you could calculate like the slight changes in winning percentage that happen.
But didn't they figure out statistically you should go for it on fourth down? Like you should never punt. You should
No,
always.
well, I think it was
Well, what was the rule?
more often than what coaches do
Okay.
is, but I don't think that's like a blanket, is it?
So, well, wasn't the guy from the coach from Los Angeles Chargers? He really adheres to that, and people just think he's a moron half the time, right? Like, yeah, like that's
Yeah.
like to your point. It's like it's one thing to do. Then, like, it's always interesting to me to see how the pundits, especially the former players, come out of the woodwork, and they're like, "I don't care what the statistics say in that scenario, you don't do that." And it's like you can feel the game, and it's just like over the long run, he's right, but over the intervening, like, it's just like, yeah, what do you do short term versus long term, and being positive expected value? You know, it's hard to, like we're saying, emotionality and behavioral changes.
I rewatched that on Sunday night. It's a great movie.
Which one,
Moneyball.
Moneyball? Oh yeah.
Moneyball?
Yeah, that is good.
Yeah. No, it's the best. Like I was giving other examples. Like Moneyball is the best, but like people forget that, like, you know, it's about the Oakland A's. And then Theo Epstein took those ideas and went to the Boston Red Sox and won the first World Series in 85 years. But then what I point out from there is the owner of the Red Sox at the time was John Henry of Fenway Sports Group. You know, and John Henry's a trend following managed futures guy, right? Where he understood statistics and probabilities, and he was trading over 60 to 80 markets, especially during the great eras of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is how he made his wealth. But then in 2010, he bought Liverpool Football Club. And most people don't like to talk about soccer because it's, you know, un-American. And I get it. I was a soccer player, and I get it's the most boring sport. Everybody hates it. But John Henry, Fenway Sports Group, buys Liverpool in 2010. And they're trying to restore this historic franchise. And in 2015, they hired Jurgen Klopp from Germany, who's one of the greatest football managers of all time. But he's known as for heavy metal football, they call it, like all-out attack. And so they're scoring lots of goals, but they're getting a lot of goals scored against them. But then 2018, they're like, we need to shore up this defense. So they went out and got Alisson Becker from Brazil, who's a goalkeeper, who was the best at the time, the best goalkeeper in the world. And they got Virgil van Dijk, the best defender in the world from the Netherlands, and he played sweeper for them. So now they shore up their defense in 2018. So going into 2019, they end up winning the Champions League, which is the most prestigious club trophy in all of soccer. And then the following year, they won the English Premier League for the first time in 30 years. So once again, it was like offense plus defense wins championships, but we all herald offense way more. And they use that kind of Moneyball approach, although I think it's a lot harder to use a Moneyball approach in things like soccer, where like baseball is awesome because you have all those discrete events. Basketball, they're getting a little bit better with all the statistics. But I was actually at the event I was just at, I was talking to Joe Pita, who's a former like baseball and sports gambler that used a lot of those theories to measure hedge fund traders, especially in market neutral long short hedge funds like 0.72. He was there. Like, and so you have a lot of discrete events with those managers, so you can derive how much alpha they're using versus the variance of the markets. And it's just kind of interesting how these things have truly taken off. But he was telling me that he finds even at some of the biggest hedge funds in the world, they're not amenable to these ideas still too. They still feel like this guy, I know he's going to come
Hot
back. He's a good
hand.
guy.
He's got
Yeah. Hot hand.
heuristics, galore.
Yeah, it's that, or it's even worse is the intangibles like Toby's talking about from Moneyball is, they used to talk about, oh, this guy's handsome or his
Good
girlfriend's
face.
ugly.
Good
Yeah,
face. Oh,
good
yeah.
face.
Yeah.
Yeah, ugly girlfriend, no confidence.
No confidence.
That's just crazy. But he was telling me how that still happens at some of the most quantitative hedge funds in the world. It's crazy.
I've been watching Full Swing, and they do the same thing in Full Swing when they choose for the Ryder Cup. They take 12 players, the top six players, they have the best score over the season. And then the coach gets the or the captain gets to choose six other players. And so they're showing Justin Thomas and somebody else, some lesser known player. Sorry, I can't remember his name. I don't actually I've only seen part one, so I don't know what happens. I haven't seen part two yet.
Good story, man.
Yeah.
But it doesn't
You
matter
kind of
that.
trailed off in the middle there, but no, like
Yeah,
you're saying,
there are
it gets
two.
better. That's actually a great show, but it is fascinating. Like, yeah, the objective versus the subjective of half and half. Yeah, and then it was Justin Thomas, it's the other guy that like he's basically had the captain always stay with him on tour and everything. They were like best friends. He's like staying in his
That's
house rent
JT.
free.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Justin
or
Thomas does that.
oh, is that
Yeah.
with JT? Okay, sorry. But yeah, I was like, and that's not going to skew his behavior. It's like just like my brother-in-law is a surgeon, and I remember when I used to spend time with him in New York, and all of these like drug companies back in the day or these surgical device manufacturers were taking him out for steak dinners and wine, and he's like, it's not affecting my opinion at all.
Yeah,
I'm like, you're
sure.
out of your mind. You
Yeah.
are out of
You could read a half of a Cialdini book and you would understand how wrong you are.
Yeah. Always benefit of the doubt. You're always, if given two choices, the one that took you the steak dinner is going to magically get that benefit of the doubt if you have a choice.
I know I'm running, pretty systematic that I look at some of the names that go in and I think people are just going to think I'm an idiot for putting this stuff in there. Like everybody knows what's wrong with this thing. And so do I. But the system likes it. So what are you going to do? Like if you, and the problem is, as I've shown, like there are lots of studies out there, not thousands, dozens of studies out there that show every time you pull out the one that you
The
think is the
worst,
loser,
yeah.
you're cherry picking out all of your best returns.
Yeah, you think yours is bad? We own a quarter of our portfolio in global bonds. Everybody thinks I'm a moron. They tell me every day. It's great.
So just before I was interested to know the four quadrants. I want to learn a little bit more about that too. But there's no part of you don't need to predict what area you're in. You're always keeping a pretty balanced. So it's not predictive at all. It's sort of
Yeah,
come what
so
may.
I know
Agnostic
you
to.
guys. Yeah, I know you guys appreciate this somewhat, but like it's amazing to me that I get invited to speak at events because I just feel like I'm the turd in the punch bowl because like everybody goes on stage and talks about their hero trade, and I go up there and I'm like, look, I can't predict the future. None of these guys can. We're all just making it's all make believe, right? Like none of us have crystal balls. Like what
Telling
are
a
we
good
doing
story.
here? Yeah, like I mean, but I fall for it every time. Like we were just talking about before we got on, like our homie Ian Castle. I went to lunch with him the other day. He's telling me about stocks, and I'm falling in love with him. I'm an
Yeah.
optimistic entrepreneur. Like I fell in love with every stock he told me about. Like I don't know how you guys do it. So yeah, see, we're non-predictive. So if you think about what was the difference between like Harry Brown's four quadrant model, which Dalio eventually copied but never gave Harry Brown credit, and he just leveraged up the bond portion. Is then, they were trying to leverage, risk parity to your variance or what people call they unfortunately have substitute variance with volatility. And so that's semi-predictive based on variance and correlation is how you would lever like the risk parity portfolio. But I like that Harry Brown just kind of gave them equal weight, because over the long enough time horizon, your kind of returns to risk are going to kind of end up being 1/n given the long enough time horizon. That's why I kind of like the equal weight of that. And if you've done risk parity in the 1930s, you would be done, game over. So the idea, though, with our four quadrant model is, like, Harry Brown used stocks for growth, bonds for disinflation or deflation, cash for recession, and gold for inflation. And the idea was, he had a rebalancing bands of, if any of them got outside of 10%, then you rebalance. So he was 25% each. If they got up to 35 or down to 15, then he'd rebalance, which worked out to about, like, every 1.4 years since, like, 1972. And it was just a
That's higher
very
than I would have thought, actually. Like, more often.
really
Yeah.
interesting. I don't know. Yeah, what I mean, who knows? But I mean, you probably went years, and then those, volatility
Oh
picks
yeah,
up your yeah,
they
so.
cluster together more.
Which, yeah, we shouldn't be talking about averages, as we can, as we all know, our Taleb, and we can drown in a river two average of 2 feet deep.
Right.
So the idea with Harry Brown's is, like, non-predictive. You're in the four global macro quadrants as they kind of move around. And then, to me, the idea is, if he were alive today and had the tools we have, instead of cash, we use long volatility and tail risk, gives you much more like a convex cash position. And instead of just gold for inflation, we like to use commodity trend advisors that can allocate to many more of those commodity markets than just gold. And so, but the idea, like you're saying, Toby, is the idea is we keep those four quadrants fixed. And so I would prefer rebalancing bands in general, as our good friend Corey Hofstein's written about rebalancing timing luck. So I'd either like rebalancing bands or to rebalance much more frequently, but given trading costs, et cetera, that's difficult. And then, just because we offer our clients monthly liquidity, we end up rebalancing monthly. So yeah, it's non-predictive, but any sort of rebalancing frequency or idea of rebalancing is essentially you could say it's pseudo market timing. But what I think about is, like, when you truly have four global macro quadrants, and an idea of rebalancing too is implicitly going to be mean reversionary, or implicitly kind of short volatility, honestly. And so the idea is, over a long arc of time, those four global macro quadrants, as money flows around the world into different asset classes, should mean revert over time. So you are making that implicit assumption that you have some form of mean reversion. But I would look at it more as forced scale trading, because when you were off, Jake and I were talking about behaviorally, what it forces me to do is to incrementally scale out of, the scale into positions as they're going into drawdown, and incrementally start selling my winners. So I'm rebalancing from my winners to the losers. And by doing that monthly, it forces me to do that. And I'm not choosing, I'm saying, ooh, I don't know, I should lighten up here. So, because if I predict the future, like, it's going to be much worse.
Yeah, I like that approach.
How do you handle the international versus US? I mean, if you weren't tipped US the last 10 years, it's, that would have been a real headwind. But we look at, like, total market cap versus economic output, and, like, people are way overweight the US relative to the rest of the world as far as that statistic goes. So how do you balance those things out with by trying to still stay agnostic?
Yeah, so also structurally, what we do is called the commodity pool operation function. You can think of it as a hedge fund. But because we set up as a commodity pool, we're in managed futures. And I say that because we use the futures indices for stock and bond markets, because that's just a specific example. And to do that, we replicate, like, MSCI ACWI. So we're, like, 60% domestic, 20%, ex-US developed, and, like, 20% emerging. And so the idea is, like, we're using all the different countries to replicate MSCI ACWI. But,
Okay.
like, I can understand. And then we do similarly on the bond side. And I think you get more of that geographic diversification from the bond side. On the stock side, I can understand the arguments that say, like, a US multinational is, like, truly multinational, and you're, like, no longer are you getting as much diversification. But implicitly, I think, without, hedging your foreign currency exposure, it's kind of also an FX bet at the end of the day too, especially on the stock side. Where the bond side, there's idiosyncratic bond markets in these different countries that may or may not be affected globally by, like, US hegemonic policies. But, like, those are, that's why we diversify. I understand the argument against, kind of diversification on the stock side, but at the end of the day, we just feel it's the right thing to do. So we just think, like, a priori, we can't predict the future. We want broad diversification. And we actually want, we know our Mandelbrot, we want fractal diversification. So not only we diversified against four quadrants, within each quadrant, we're using broad diversification as well. Like you said, we're going globally instead of domestic. But at the same time, going back to, like, everybody hates us, right? Because, like you said, US is outperforming. And so we were just like, there was a brief period, like a few quarters ago, a few months ago, where foreign started to jump out from behind the curtain, and we were like, finally, and then smash back down. So,
Did you get a chance to rebalance some of that profit away?
of course.
There you go. Caught some of it.
Yeah, so you also get a rebalancing premium too. Like, well, Corey's going to beat me up for calling it a premium, but because it's just what it is. Like, it's just a through diversification and rebalancing, right? There's this unique mathematical phenomenon where you can actually derive a return just from rebalancing diversification through time, which can give you an anywhere from an extra 1 to 4% on an annualized basis. If your asset classes are fairly volatile and uncorrelated or negatively correlated, you also garner a little bit of rebalancing premium. Even if all those asset classes went nowhere, but they were volatile and uncorrelated, negatively correlated, you could still harness that rebalancing premium through time.
It can go down too. That's that Shannon's demon.
Shannon's demon, right?
Yep,
Yeah.
yep.
Classic.
Yeah, Shannon was like I don't know about you guys, but that kind of broke my mind back in like 2007, 2008, and
In
I've been
Fortune's
thinking about it
formula,
ever since.
that's where it came out, right? Yeah, it's amazing. So how are you building the business? What's the you were doing Real Vision for a while. Are you still doing Real Vision?
No. So yeah, I did in 2020, mid 2020, right? Vol got hot. So they wanted to talk about volatility on Real Vision, and it just so happens we're at like the nexus of the vol markets because, I mean, we allocate to 14 vol managers. We track like 30 to 40 total. So I know pretty much anybody and everybody in the vol space. I know all their strategies, et cetera. And so when people want to come, they want to know like what's going on in the vol space, they come through us and they want to talk to me about what's going on. And so that's how that Real Vision whole thing started, just because volatility was sexy again, right? And then over the intervening years, volatility hasn't been as sexy. And now everybody hates it again, which is great for me because the price of tail risk is at the lowest
Oh,
point it's been since like
so
2017
cheap
to
now.
2019. Yeah, it's great. If you can stay alive, it's great. And then, Real Vision moved much towards crypto. I miss the old days when it was just more of those long form Grant Williams style interviews about to show me how you think, not like what to trade this week. I miss those kind of days. So I did a lot of that, like as Toby's saying back in the day, and that led to a lot of other podcasting, et cetera. We put out our own podcast
Yeah,
for a
you and
while.
Corey had a great
Yeah,
one.
thank you. Everybody says that, but like, I don't know. It feels like I'm always surprised, like who watches it, like or say they watch it. Like it always surprised me come out of the woodwork. Because as you guys know, it's like you're in like your office or your living room talking to your computer. Like
I
you
know.
don't realize anybody. Like those numbers, like you see like a few thousand people on there, but like it's just a number, right? And then especially like the Real Vision stuff, like my kind of public facing presence came during 2020. So during the pandemic and everything, I was really just talking to a computer and then coming out of it, going to events and people knowing your name that you don't know. I'm sure you guys have to deal with this all the time. It's that weird parasocial relationship where you're just like, they're like,
It's
Toby, how are
freaking
you
you out
doing?
a
How
little
are,
bit.
yeah, like they're starting to ask you like all this stuff in your personal life and you're like, oh man, this is asymmetric. But yeah, so going back to Corey and I, so yeah, that had like kind of three stages to it. Like the first one we did is like I had been slowly like sandpapering Corey's balls for like a year to do something together, and he was against it. And by the way, he credit full shout out to Corey. Like he had the power dynamic in that relationship, right? He was the one that has garnered that amazing reputation that I can only bring down, which is probably why we ended it in the long run because I'm a loose cannon. But so what we were doing is like we were trying to think what we could do together. And it was during the pandemic, and people were starting to podcast, even though podcasts are still not as prevalent as they should be in our industry. And so we were trying to think like, what could we do differently? We talked about maybe live podcasting everything, but you guys already have a lock on that, and Resolve was doing it too. And we found out we both had a mutual love.
Pirates.
Yeah, we both had a mutual love for vlogging and like these more scripted, more edited vlogs. And we're like, nobody in our industry is doing that. Let's try it. And so that's what we decided to do. We actually were like an hour before recording our first live podcast and then cancel it and like, no, let's do something completely different. And then we came up with this original concept for Pirates of Finance. And it was a lot of fun, but like it happened during the pandemic. So we had a lot more time on our hands. And the like editing burden of doing those structured videos and putting out one a week was starting to get to be a nightmare. But the positive thing we had that you guys know all too well is like we didn't have to chase guests. Like we just had to be loyal to each other and be there every week for each other. Because as you know, it might seem simple to get guests, but every week in, week out, those guests drop off. They don't show up. It's kind of a nightmare of herding cats for guests. So we were happy to do just the two of us. But then the editing burden got too high, so we had to put a pause on it after we came out of the pandemic. And then Blockworks reached out to us and wanted to do something. And we're like, yeah, we can't do that again, but maybe we can do a podcast together. And so then we started doing that on Blockworks. But that audience was much more crypto and global macro, which, as you heard me say, like, I don't have a crystal ball. Corey and I aren't into that kind of stuff. We just think it's like masturbation generally. So we don't even do it. So then that was the wrong audience for us. And then we redid Pirates of Finance, doing just a live podcast, primarily on YouTube on Fridays. And yeah, we enjoyed that for a nice long run too. And then, life got in the way. And then I started to get worried that I was going to get Corey canceled. And so, like, he's already done me too many favors. And I don't want my ability. I always makes me nervous doing these live ones, because I'm like, I'm going to say something that's going to get us all canceled. And thankfully I haven't done it yet, but I just feel
Let's
like
dig into
the,
that a little bit. What are you going to say that's going to get us canceled?
I don't know. I've
Put
said a
us out
lot
of
of
our
things.
misery.
I've said a lot of things, yeah, where my business partner's like, we should have like a grandma grandpa rule. Like, if you don't want to offend them, then it's probably not a good idea. And like, to me, it's like, as long as we don't talk about numbers or returns or irrational promises, like, we should be able to talk about anything.
Yeah. Well,
Let's
if we
talk.
hadn't, if between Bill and Toby and I, if we haven't got ourselves canceled at this point, it's probably not going to happen. I don't know.
I think it's like the, when the law firm sends you requests for discovery, and you just send them so much stuff that they can't get, like, you
Yeah.
hide the smoking
It's
gun
a
and just piles of
blizzard.
stuff. That's what we've
Yeah.
done, the blizzard approach.
But I love what you guys are doing. And also, I'm also bipolar about it, because I feel like saying, oh, I'm afraid of getting canceled, it's like, I'm not that controversial. Like, and I just hate when people like keep using that now as like some sort of excuse where they think they're a badass. Like, you're just not. You're not gonna get, nobody cares. But what I do love, what you guys do, that I was really adamant about Corey and I in the third iteration of Pirates, is like, I think most of the people in our industry are afraid of being themselves. So that's why the bulk of the podcast and everything in our industry is purely interview, purely like semi-scripted. They're going through
Yeah.
the motions and making sure they touch all the talking points. Where to come on these sort of live podcasts and just shoot the shit about nothing, and we had nothing prepared. You guys didn't send me any questions. I didn't send you talking points. Is like, that's where our industry is headed, if you're willing to go there. Because like we said, those parasocial relationships, people see who you guys are week in and week out. And quite frankly, a lot of times they know you better than your own families because of the variety of things you're willing to talk about if you go live without an agenda. But it's fascinating to me that like, that's a blue ocean, because our industry is so afraid of being themselves or getting found out that maybe like they don't have a crystal ball, like that they are just some guy.
Compliance is a little bit frightening in that regard, if you got public facing stuff.
Well, yeah. So to your point, like, you can't, even though you have the step and repeat banner behind you, is like, that's what we did for Corey's thing. So he didn't have to, like, because we have different compliance, right? Me under NFA and him in ETFs, is like, you just can't talk about what he does, right? So that was the other thing. It's like, that was also drove us to talk about other things. It's like, we can't talk about what Corey does, so let's just talk about other things. But I was surprised, like, I get more DMs about, like, when I would talk about, as my PSA to young men is like, or young women, it's like, you should cook with unsalted butter, and then you salt the taste as you're cooking. But I would get more DMs about unsalted butter than I'd ever get about like commodity trend following.
Let's talk about volatility a little bit. I didn't I like volatility, and I've Chris is a good friend of mine, so I've talked a lot of volatility over the years. And I've traded it. I don't think I've
Flushed a fair
actually
amount of premiums down the
flushed a
toilet.
lot of premium. I've also
Yeah.
had a few big winners that expired worthless. So I'm no good at it. I like it as an idea, but can you just run through a little bit? There's a spectrum of volatility. I think that people, they either think that it's like a Taleb type thing, where you're waiting for something to blow up, and that's when you get this, like, once in a 7, 10 year, 15 year, I don't know how long since we've had a proper blow up. And then there are others. There's crisis over, and, like, just what's the spectrum?
Yeah, so you guys have talked about it a bit before, and you had our buddy Jim Carroll on before talking about volatility. But classically, like you said, the Taleb or Spitznagel type is pure tail risk protection. And the idea is like, you're 97% long S&P, and you spend 3% of your premium to truncate your left tail, let's say beyond a negative 20% drawdown. The idea there is just like insurance, is like, your 3% is your premium spend on your insurance. The negative 20% drawdown is the deductible, and then you're covering beyond that point. That's classic kind of Spitznagel Taleb tail risk protection. We could talk about how they get there, and how people actually, trade these to actually get them done right at
Lower
an
the
institutional
costs.
class. Yeah, lower the cost at institutional level. But that's the general idea. And the idea there is like, if, like Toby's saying, these come along once every 10 years, It's about rebalancing and buying those assets at the lower NAV point that I talked about earlier. And the idea is like, yes, it's a negative EV trade, especially if you're, say, spending, 3% a year for 10 years and then maybe only make 20, 30%, 40, 50, whatever it is in the sell-off. It looks like a negative EV trade, but it's about the emergent effects of the portfolio over time, right? And then more importantly, as Taleb said more recently, is like, if you don't have portfolio insurance, you don't have a portfolio, right? It's like having a coastal Florida house in a hurricane belt that's $10 million and not having insurance on it. Well, you better save up $10 million in cash if you want to rebuild that thing or more, into the future. So that's the general idea on classical tail risk. So the problem is, like you just said, we were talking about, is behaviorally, people didn't like that 3% bleed. So then what people in what we colloquially call long volatility is, I would argue that's more of the opportunistic tail trading, and it could be on the left or the right tail, but the idea is you don't need to have that permanently on tail risk. You can wait for the right conditions to kind of put that on to lower your cost. So the idea is like a forest fire analogy, right? If we're looking at wind levels, we're looking at ground humidity levels, we're looking at lightning strikes, all those sorts of things, and then we're going to buy our tail protection on either the lighter, left or right tail. That's the idea of like more opportunistic long vol trading. And the idea is that, right, they're trying to lower that cost over time, but then you're giving up a deterministic bleed for a variable kind of return as you're trying to lower that, because you might spend more, you might spend less, and
And
you
there's a
might have
chance you
more
miss it.
of a chance you miss it, like, and we can get into like, there's still a chance you miss it on the deterministic ones because you still have to monetize it correctly, right? So that's the difficulty. So then you think about that opportunistic, and then you can start to think about your paths of moneyness, right? Like, are you getting closer to at the money? Do you want out of the money? You want deep out of the money? Where are you trying to, monetize that? So then you could get into more what's called long gamma style trading, where you're closer to at the money, and you might trade like calendars for that. Like, you might be long, a 1 week option at the money, short an option 3, 4 months out, maybe 5, 10% out of the money, and then maybe long some teenies on the back end just to protect yourself against that, try to make it vague and neutral, but still stay long gamma. And the idea there is you capture more realized vol, and you get more rebalancing opportunities over time. So it's just a different style of doing that trading. So those are the kind of the options complex. The other one we work with is what we call vol relative value, or stat arb in the vol space, where basically you're using, the differences in the intra-market spread between S&P and VIX, both on the future side, the option side, et cetera, where you're just, it's pairs trading, right? So it's a form of implicit short volatility if you're trying to make a little money off those pair trades. And we could try to use that to cover the cost of the bleed of that premium on the long volatility and tail risk side. So that's another way of doing it. And then the last bucket, the way we do it, is just what we call short delta trading, or just using those managed futures positions to use intraday trend following. So the problem is, after that vol spike event happens, and let's say you monetize your tail risk, well, now I'm naked moving forward. So how do I protect myself, right? If I want to buy more options, the implied volatility spikes so much, it's going to be really prohibitive. That insurance is going to be incredibly high and you're going to bleed. So if you just short the market index futures globally, on an intraday basis, you're not paying up for that implied volatility. It's a directional bet. You're just going short delta. So it's another, trend following intraday is a really tough job, and very few people have ever pulled it off well. But that's just another way of covering that bleed. I will say, I'll throw it out there, we actually don't use anybody that shorts equities, because I believe it's a negative EV trade over the long run for many reasons. One, the whole stock market is set up against you, right? You put on a tiny position, then you get your face ripped off, as everybody saw in short squeezes with the meme stocks. But then even better, like worse, is like 2008 happens, you're actually up on your shorts, but then Goldman Sachs either increases your borrow, or your margin, or just kind of blocks you out of the trades and takes over your books, as they did with Mark Cohodes. So like, there's just nightmare scenarios along those lines, where I literally like those deterministic puts that you can buy and kind of have that protection across listed exchanges. So I think that gives you kind of the broad gamut there, Toby. Like, we could talk about, like you said, like on tail risk, it's really easy, I think. If people read Spitznager or Taleb, and actually Jesse Felder wrote a great blog post about how to do this yourself. But the problem is, I find if you're buying that deep out of the money tail risk, like a lot of people will buy 3 months out and they'll roll it every 2 months. And the idea there is, so like, one, you're not really looking at the vol surfaces as much as an individual trader as professional institutions are, and you're getting picked off, right? You're probably buying the most expensive part of the vol surface. You're doing it by doing it systematically. Those people are constantly getting picked off, especially even like the ETFs doing their collar trades, et cetera. The other thing is that people don't realize is the execution cost for an individual to put on those trades, right? If you're buying teenies and they're anywhere for 2 to 4 cents, and you have to cross that spread, that's the difference between a 50x return and a 25x return. And that's dramatically going to protect your protection over time. So actually, the trading costs are like more in that 20, 30, 40% for individuals trying to pull these trades off. And then the hardest part, even if the institution gets all of those execution, they get all that right, when do you monetize? How do you monetize? How do you roll these positions? That's easier said than done. And people use different monetization heuristics. And that's why we use an ensemble of them. Because, like you said, if this happens once every 5, 10, 15 years, we got to make sure we capture the meat of that move. And you can't have, can't have like, if three or four of our managers say, oops, sorry, I didn't monetize it correctly. Well, we still have, another dozen managers to monetize that correctly because we don't want egg on our face. And that tends to happen over time. And then the other thing that people hate about tail risk hedging, as we saw in 23, and we already knew this would happen, is, or sorry, 22, is if you have a really low vol environment and the market just grinds lower and lower, and Jim talked about this on yours, it's like you're not going to get that pop in volatility. So you're going to spend all that premium. You're not really going to catch the short deltas. And so the market's down and your tail risk is down. And so then people have a hard time dealing with it. But this is why everybody's gotten rid of tail risk insurance and why it's so much cheaper now, which excites me. But to give you an idea, across our ensemble of managers in 22, there's about a 65% dispersion. Our top manager was up 35% in 22. Our bottom manager was down 30. And
And it
so this
was
is why
probably
we.
just whoever was had the most convexity on, probably they didn't get paid. And then is that right?
Yeah, the one that was down didn't do anything wrong. It was a long, pure long vega play, right? But then the long gamma guys did well. Or then, as Toby actually referenced earlier, short delta guys did okay. But then also you have cross asset vol. So like the other thing is like most of our clients are tied to S&P. So when the S&P vol is incredibly high, you still have to pay that premium if you want that deterministic protection. But you can, what we do around the edges is we sprinkle in cross asset vol, looking across asset classes around the globe and use a manager that uses 7 to 10 year leaps on cross asset vol. And that really helps in like a 22 scenario where you're getting pops in rate vol, you're getting some pops in commodity vol and FX vol. So you want to be able to make a little money on those at the time being, but you can't use those liberally because now you have basis risk. Because once again, if the S&P crashes and you're like, oh, sorry, we were in this exotic pairs trade over here, like it doesn't work.
Do you want to predict where volatility is going to be for over a period of time?
Have you been listening this whole time,
Yeah,
Toby? What
this
is
is my
How do you
favorite
feel?
question. To my favorite question, I have no idea, nor does anybody
Yeah.
else. But what I do love is what we're referencing is there's this like Hyman Minsky like moment where stability breeds instability, and the beautiful thing about tail risk protection, it gets the cheapest before the event. And so, but so you go, great, I should be loading up on it now. It's cheap, and I go, whoa, not so fast. Like Brent from Spot Gamma put out a great chart the other day on excess returns that was showing it's been just until the other day, it was about we were over 400 days without a move larger than -2% S&P, right? So
Yeah,
you
it's
go,
crazy.
wow. But then this is gambler's fallacy, right? You're like, oh, I've had 400 reds, time to bet on
Yeah.
black. Because before Volmageddon in February 2018, we had gone 500 days. And then the one that's even more interesting is going to the GFC in 2007, we had gone almost 1400 days. So just
Jesus.
because vol's cheap and that stability breeds instability doesn't make it predictive of when it's going to happen. What it does though, it allows us to load up, especially if you're kind of doing a fixed spend, you can be over leveraged to that event. And then you're just waiting and waiting and it keeps getting cheaper for us. So I keep buying more on that fixed spend basis, which helps me once again, scale trade kind of in that position. And then my buddy Jerry Hayworth at 36 South said about his only predictor of when of all events is going to happen is when he's getting a lot of redemptions. So as we all know, the CalPERS thing, like
It's
that
about
sort of
to,
thing.
yeah, it's
Yeah,
about to pay
that's what
off.
exactly.
That's great.
JT, do you want to squeeze in some veggies?
I will, yes. So, I try to avoid doing book reports when I can, but this one's a bit of a book report. And it's this book called Prediction Machines and the Simple Economics of Artificial Intelligence, written by three professors at the University of Toronto's Business School. And, it's a little dry, like you would expect from professors and academics. So I'm going to try to spice it up with a little bit of storytelling here. But so our story opens in 1850 with an infant girl, and she's just 5 months old. And this girl's father, who's 27, kisses the baby and slips away, never to see her again. It's Splitsville with his 23-year-old wife, and the father goes on to have many more adventures. But he's already achieved rock star status in England at that point for his poetry. And he's eventually known for his excesses, his huge debts, and his love affairs. And he dies during the Greek War of Independence against the Ottoman Empire in 1824 at just 36, probably likely of malaria. But his name was George Gordon Byron, aka Lord Byron. And his daughter, Ada, grew up with no father and an aristocratic, hypochondriac mother. And Ada's childhood was this isolated experience of really full of like very rigid, enforced education. And at 17, she happened to meet this local inventor and engineer named Charles Babbage. And apparently she charmed him enough that he invited Ada and her mother to see this demonstration that he put together. He built this 2,000-piece brass parts assembled into a hand crank contraption that, when he could turn it, he could actually raise numbers to the power of, square, or to the power of the third, or take the root of a quadratic equation with this like brass machine that you crank on. So seeing this early mechanical calculator sparked in Ada an interest in mathematics. And what she continued intense study while she also got married, had three kids. And then in 1838, she met Queen Victoria, who was just 18 at the time. And Ada's husband was made an earl for his government work that he was doing. And Ada then became the Countess of Lovelace. And so history now knows her as Ada Lovelace. And her work at developing a calculator, she helped to develop a sequence of rational numbers, actually Bernoulli numbers, for Babbage's machine. And so she's considered actually to be the first complete execution of a computer program is her in a mechanical version. But and really before anyone else, she understood the machine's potential for universal application. Like it could be programmed to do virtually anything. And she wrote, and I quote, "We might even invent laws for series or formulae in an arbitrary manner and set the engine to work upon them and thus deduce numerical results which we might not otherwise have thought of obtaining." And yet, Ada also saw the intrinsic limitations of this type of machine. The analytical engine has no pretensions, that's what it was called, to originate anything. It can do whatever we know how to do in order to perform. And so really, like she said, only when computers originate things should they believe to have minds. And Alan Turing then later, who was, you guys have seen The Imitation Game, he called this Lady Lovelace's objection. Basically, like, if the computer's not computers don't think, they just do things that we already know how to do. And sadly, Lovelace died at age 36 of cancer. So there's lots of hype around AI right now. And why I like this book is because it took some basic economic first principles and then applied it to AI. So the main thrust was that AI is going to lower the cost of prediction. And lowering the cost of any input has very understandable consequences. So they point out that, the rise of the internet led to a drop in the cost of distribution, communication, and search. So without the internet, it would be really expensive for the three of us to go and put on a show that people could watch, right? It would cost a fortune. We'd never be able to do it, probably. No one would want to watch. So they reframe this technological advance as a shift from expensive to cheap and scarce to abundant. So when computers started getting cheaper and more reliable, easier to use, the cost of doing arithmetic fell dramatically. And then humans found new ways to use arithmetic that no one had dreamed before. So like they substituted basically like chemistry solution of photography for arithmetic-based solution of digital imaging. So we take our tools and we figure out how new ways to do it. So a lot of times you're thinking that AI means like Skynet and robots taking over the world and Wall-E, where machines are, they've removed all the need for humans to think. But what they're pointing out is that thinking will remain actually a very dear resource. But what's getting cheap and ubiquitous will be the predictions. And just to like show what does a prediction really mean? It's simply the process of filling in missing information. It takes the information you have, called data, uses a model to understand it, and then generates information you don't have. So cheaper predictions will mean more predictions and more complements to those predictions, like the economic sense of the word complement. Complements are data, judgment, action, and then outcomes that are fed back as information in like feedback loops. So but it'll also diminish the value of substitutes, which often means human prediction. So maybe like a easy to understand version of this is if a cabbie in London, for instance, has all of this inf the knowledge, right? All this information in their head about how to get places. Well, along comes Waymo or Google Maps or whatever it is, and now all of a sudden the value of their predictions of how the best way to get there has dramatically dropped, but yet everyone else can do it for much cheaper now, right? So everyone sort of gets the same experience, but at a much lower cost. So predictions can then facilitate decisions by reducing uncertainty. Like, what time should I leave for the airport? Like, it's going to help me understand that. I guess reading a 5-day weather forecast is now as accurate as a 1-day forecast was 15 years ago, which is a pretty
That's
big
amazing.
advancement. I know, isn't it? One of the key complements of prediction is judgment. And judgment is the skill to determine payoffs, utility, reward, profit for a particular action. So, and what is we have to still be able to tell AI, like, what do we want to maximize for? A prediction of rain doesn't really mean much if the AI doesn't know how much you like staying dry or how much you hate carrying an umbrella, right? So judgment as a complement prediction then will increase in value. And the more predictions will then mean that we have more opportunities for judgment. So judgment is actually going to be an increasingly important asset to bring to the equation, in addition to having more predictions from the machines. So there'll be more decisions to make than ever, actually. So we as humans, we do a lot of satisficing, which is sort of like, let's make a quick decision, pick the most likely satisfactory option, and then like limit the amount of brain power that we need to expend. But as prediction gets cheaper, it's going to reduce the need for us to satisfice and cause us to rethink many of our many like daily commercial decisions that we make. So for instance, and some of these are very like counterintuitive. I like so let's take airport lounges, for instance. They exist only to make it less of a pain to arrive too early for a flight. Like you didn't know what time you should show up, so you go early and then you sit in the airport lounge. Well, that's an airport lounge is a solution to a poor prediction. But if we get better data about when you should leave, when you should arrive, tighten up those time schedules, get better predictions, we can cut out our arrival time to a much closer level, and then we reduce the value of the airport lounge. So there's all these little like things of how it's going to change the world, but I don't think it's probably not going to be, robots, crushing your skull or whatever, like in at the beginning of Terminator. So anyway, hopefully a little bit of a fun story of Lord Byron, Ada Lovelace, and some more practical takeaways for trying to understand how AI is going to impact us going forward.
Man, there's so many things in that one I want to pull out. One, I'm sure you guys have you guys read your Roy Sutherland, like Alchemy and stuff like that, where like
Oh yeah,
they're trying
so
to
good.
make like a faster train. He's like, why don't we slow down the train and make a better experience, right? Like
Yes.
that sort of thing. Like, so like you said, we have emotions that we have to attend with. The other one was like, I think about everything in life is like we unfortunately like only understand the world through closed loop systems. That's the way our brains work and how we understand complex systems. And yet the whole world is like kind of open loop. It has a permeability to it. And so it always makes me wonder, like, everybody's worried about AI, but like it's going to reduce tasks, not jobs, right? Like you're saying, people have judgment and they won't have to, like, it's advanced spreadsheets, right? They'll get better and better at those predictions on things they can use, but it's never necessarily going to take away our jobs of judgment in the sense that, the problem is, like I started with, is like, the markets are a non-ergodic system due to our individual path dependencies through life or our sequencing risk. And then more importantly, we have non-stationarity of data. And it doesn't matter, right? If you feed 100 years of data into an AI and that just came after the Spanish flu, so it didn't have a COVID-like pandemic in its data set, you need the judgment of the human that knows like crazy shit can happen that aren't in that data set and then can shift markets dramatically because there's a non-stationarity issue with that data that the AI is never going to really probably overcome. And maybe I'm just saying that solipsistically because I want to have a job, but like, maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you also have the problem too is that if the that kind of observer effect that if the AI is in there doing things, it changes and makes the data from the past when it wasn't there no longer a relevant reference case.
No, this, or like Toby, I'm sure you have to deal with this. Like, they're still finding errors to the CRISPR data. Like, can we just get that right?
You're right.
Yeah, ongoing. It's amazing. The law of ever-changing cycles is something from, I forget whose book it is now, but it's a great
Sounds
story
like
about.
a Will Durant type of
No, I don't
thing.
know. He traded for Soros. He wrote a book. I can't believe I can't remember his name, but he talks about going to the racetrack at the start of the season. And he bets, he's betting, he's not looking for the winner, he's looking for the best
Mispriced.
odds. And
Yeah.
the odds shift over the course of the
Oh, is that
season, everybody.
Jim, what's his last name?
Rogers.
Rogers. Is that
It's
what
not
it is?
Druckenmiller. So, somebody,
Yeah.
Hive Mind, tell me who that is. The book is Education of, it's Victor Niederhofer, Education of a
Oh,
Speculator.
Victor.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Law of Ever-Changing Cycles. It's, I don't know whether the introduction of a lot more AI or faster decision-making loops means that our cycles are faster. I mean, I sort of feel like our cycles have been a little bit faster recently from, I feel like we had COVID crash, pandemic bubble, value cycle, back to end of
Yeah.
cycle, boom.
And then
But we've
back
had it
to
in like
value
inside like
sucking
4 years.
again.
Yeah, it's
You
like
had
the
a
Lenin
lifetime in
quote.
4 years.
Yeah. Yeah, you get the Lenin quote, but like to your point though, that means that like using our judgment or better our imagination and substitute for the word judgment is like you can imagine that the liquidity cascades could get worse as we as algorithms become more prevalent, right? And we go through these cycles at a more rapid pace. There's probably a larger opportunity for less left tail liquidity cascades potentially. And that would require judgment or creativity or thinking through like what's possible that hasn't happened before.
I think you see that quite a bit, even with like, it feels to me like that there's still a lot of spoofing of bids in the market where you're like, it looks like liquidity, but then if you actually tried to buy or sell something, it's no longer there at that price. I think this high frequency, I don't know if that's the, it's probably the those guys, but like, I'm not sure. I think they just unplug the machine anytime it's like starts to get a little too crazy, and it's like all this promised liquidity disappears.
Yeah, because they're in a way they're great. They're great. Like I've seen people that try to invest in like Virtu and others as like a long volatility play because as markets become more volatile and they expand, they have more data set or opportunities. But then more importantly, if they unplug the machine because they can get blown out and then they wait for it to expand, they still retain some of that fresh capital. They plug it back in,
Plug them
margins
back
have
in.
increased. They're good to go. But like they got to survive that interim period when we go from, low volatility to high volatility. If they can, like you said, like they can unplug and replug in at the same, that's their market timing, is who's got the finger trigger on the plug.
Yeah, you don't want to night capital yourself over the afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. Toby, you know what you miss? My favorite part of this show is when you say where people are watching from.
Oh,
Or now
yeah.
nobody's watching. I've just bored them to
Let
tears.
me let me let me give a shout out because I do feel bad that I had to go and return some videotapes halfway through the call.
You went to Blockbuster?
I
Yeah,
had
what?
to get them back. Senator Domingo, San Diego, what's up? Highland Park, Illinois, Valparaiso, Ericeira, Surf Town, Portugal. Nice one. Yeah, I'm going to come and visit you. Rijeka, Croatia, Scotland, what's up? Camas, WA, Savonlinna, Finland, Aloha, Honolulu, Cromwell, New Zealand, Brandon, Mississippi, Sarasota, Florida. Good racetrack out there. Sook, British Columbia,
Just when I
Virginia
thought the
Beach.
show couldn't get more disorganized, we've now moved the 470 from to the end of the show.
Barcelona, Tesla Crashville,
Ooh.
London. Bacon Memes has been on fire. I just
Oh,
haven't been able to
God.
call them out, but I'll give you a shit.
Hilarious. Yeah, always
Some of these have been
hilarious.
good.
Yeah, he was on when Corey, well, that was part of the fun when Corey and I did Pirates of Finance live on YouTube. It was the same thing. It's like the chat was just insane. And if we wanted to get canceled, we would just read the chat. Like the chat would just get devolved into this, the craziest, most hilarious stuff. And then Corey would block it off. And I was like trying to, just in case there's questions in there. And I would be so distracted by the chat every time. You just see me looking over and laughing hysterically.
I don't know
And
how
Corey's
Toby
like, what
does
the?
it, honestly. I have to keep it off, otherwise I wouldn't
Yeah.
like I'd be so checked out from the conversation.
Bacon says
Toby.
Pirates of Finance was too pure and beautiful for this world.
See, you gotta love it. So
I got another good one too. Volatility, it can revert to the mean or it can cluster, but what happens when volatility meme reverts?
nice.
Ooh.
I'm gonna use that one.
Bacon's if artificial incompetence rises, then I'll be worried I'll be replaced. Yeah, Bacon's on fire.
Toby, I was curious, you obviously I was watching some of your other interviews the other day, and like, the Einhorn thing comes up nonstop. I'm sure for you guys have to just contend with it all the time. I can't remember if it was in that interview or another one. I'm curious, your guys' thoughts is thinking about Rory Sutherland and behavioral biases is I think Einhorn was said, I think it was him that was, and I think it was in that interview, he was like saying that when his fund was open for like 5 years, he couldn't raise any capital. And then when he closed it down for like
And
10
that's
years,
when all
but
the
reopened
capital
it like
came in.
four times, he's like raised billions of dollars. I'm
Yeah,
just curious, did you
behaviorally.
do, yeah, behaviorally, what do you like? Because everybody likes walking through a door marked private, I guess. Like, isn't that like, I struggle with that question. Like, it's
Yeah.
very interesting,
Yeah.
isn't
How
it?
do you put the velvet rope up in front of an ETF?
Yeah.
I somehow have managed to make it very
Yeah.
exclusive.
It's very hard to get
Very,
into.
very exclusive.
Just a handful. There are dozens of us.
It's been a tough run for value. Like it just cannot get out of its own way. I don't know. Just terrible stocks or something actually doing what they're maybe the that's not true. That's not true. The performance sucks so bad. It was like the worst in 200 years, according to Mikhail Samanov, who produced this 200 years of value
I
great
dispute
chart.
that claim though, Toby. It's not, it's relative though. Like absolute, it's been just fine. I mean,
That's true.
it's hitting the ball down the fairway.
That's true. That's true. But then that like late 2020, September 2020, it definitely seemed to turn around, and it's been working since then. It's just the it's still in a drawdown. It hasn't recovered from the drawdown, and it's going to be a long time. I mean, it's funny that the smalls are so smashed up now too, relative to the bigger stuff. There really needs to be. I think what has traditionally happened at the end of a cycle is there's been a big flush, and the flush is the thing that gives everybody, just reminds everybody that there's downside, and they become a little bit less aggressive on the, mega multiple investing.
But
But
the
we just haven't had a flush.
toilet's clogged right now.
Yeah,
We haven't had a
totally
flush
clogged.
for a long time.
Well, as you know, like that's what people don't realize. Like people are always like the S&P 500, just growthy Momo index is like you can be all value. It's just the cataclysmic shift that's going to happen is going to be really painful to then like the and then it'll all of a sudden be it'll, the S&P like SPY will look like a value investing index, but like to get there
It's
is
someday
brutal.
value will be momentum, those names,
Yeah,
right?
that's what I'm saying. Exactly. It comes around. I was wondering, I haven't fleshed this out, so give me some grace on this. Is like, as you're saying, Toby, you're saying 200 years, maybe worse than 200 years, is like you had to hold the faith and hold the line. And I was thinking, like, I studied comparative religions in college and like Eastern philosophy, but I was thinking about like our portfolio being generally agnostic. Is I'm also agnostic to all of like the faith-based investing protocols, right? Whether you're a growth investor, you're a factor investor, you're a value investor, you're a trend follower, it always goes through any of those, go through a period of like 10 years of underperformance where they're just towing the line. But it's a faith-based investing practice. I think that's fascinating. It's like you guys congregate together because like in a huddle in a mass, like you can keep each other warm during those lean years and you keep each other involved and invested, but it really is a faith-based exercise.
Oh, and it's religious wars too. I
That's
mean,
what I'm saying. Like
between them.
that's why people, go head to head so hard because it's like, no, my God's better than your God.
It's wild.
And on that note, that's time. Thanks, Jason.
Oh, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that was great, dude.
Jason Buck, Cockroach Portfolio. How can folks follow along with what you're doing or get in touch with you?
Yeah, go to mutinyfund.com. We just rolled out a new website, and unlike everybody else, we have like everything's on there. Like you can track everything we do. We're really proud of what we rolled out there, and my business partner Taylor Pearson does all this great writing that I'm, stealing and referencing on this podcast. But yeah, you can find us at mutinyfund.com on X/Twitter. You can find me at Jason C. Buck, and my partner's at Taylor Pearson Me.
Both very good follows.
Yeah, I second that. How about you, JT? What if folks want to get in touch, follow
Don't worry
along.
about it. Oh, well, we should say though that Berkshire coming up, and I don't know if we won't have a live audio version out until like after Berkshire.
Oh, that's a
So
good point.
this is
Yeah.
the closest one to that. So I'm sure
We'll
we're
be
gonna do
there.
something again. Probably check Twitter. We'll like post something and we'll hang out after the show. But if you see Toby, come say hi to him.
And JT.
Well, Toby will be the very tall, handsome looking one, and then I'll be the guy hobbling behind him.
With a big crowd of people around him.
Yeah, right.
All right, folks.